This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from the team at Lad Bible who bring you Minutes With. If you've ever watched an episode, you'll know the type of stories you can expect from us. Gangsters.
The police has come round with guns. No, they're right, now we're f***.
Hackers.
We hacked the Prime Minister of Tunisia.
Spies.
The whole of the area where we were was infested with Stasi vehicles.
And people who've been through unique experiences.
You know, one thing you should know about espionage, as well as bomb making, the first mistake is your last mistake.
In this new series, we get stuck into a more in-depth conversation with some extraordinary people who've led extraordinary lives.
I don't mind talking about it because I'm not ashamed. And I didn't realise that anyone would find out or know, or anyone would judge me for it.
I'm Ben Powell-Jones, and in this episode we sit down with Craig Harrison, a former British Army sniper. We first met Craig in November 2020, and his episode of Minutes With is one of the most successful ever, but also one that really affected our crew. Craig served in the Army for 23 years and underwent intensive training for his role, arguably one of the toughest in the forces, demanding complete focus for days at a time.
But I've been beyond the scope for a week.
Yeah,
in Afghan in a place called Pandas Ridge, and I was on my own.
He's well known for once holding the world record for the longest kill, taking out Taliban machine gunners on a tour in 2009. But soon after, Craig started to develop PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and was eventually discharged from the army in 2014, being put on permanent sick leave.
And something clicked in my head. It was like all the tours that I've been on, everything that I've seen, everything that I've done, this wall had just fucking shattered. And I couldn't control my emotions.
Craig's an elite level fighter, and he towers over you. He's built like a rugby player with tattoos all up his arms. But you can see straight away when you talk to him, there's a much softer side. We hear how Craig's career pushed him to the brink and how he still struggles to process his experiences with death and violence today. A warning before we get into this episode that it contains some graphic descriptions and discussion of suicidal feelings. This is Craig's story. So Craig, obviously we've met a couple of times over the last few years, but for anyone that's watching or listening for the first time, would you mind introducing yourself, who you are?
Yeah, I'm Craig Harrison. I held the longest sniper kill on record in Afghan in 2010 and in the army for 23 years, just under 23 years. And so that's my story.
Well, let's get straight into it. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and how you grew up?
Yeah, basically, I had a good childhood, you know, and we went on a horse riding holiday when I was a kid. And my mum said, "Do you want a horse?" So, yeah, she got us a horse. And I loved it. And that's all I did as a child is do pets, horses, do my mum's dogs and stuff like that.
Looking after animals.
Yeah. And my granddad always said to me when he was alive, you know, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And he said, "Get a trade." He was ex-RAF. My mum was ex-RAF as well. And I wanted to become a farrier. And that's why I joined the army. I joined the Household Cavalry to get a trade.
So how did that progress into where you ended up?
Basically, you think, right? Like I said, I was a shower child. Mm-hmm. So now I'm in the army. I'm in the central London. I get paid. I'm a weekend fucking millionaire.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm like, what the fuck? Country boy in the middle of the city. And I got led astray by the older sort of generation and doing fights, getting drunk and stuff like that. I'd never been drunk before.
Really?
And it's the first time I was in the army. I went out to a nightclub, got absolutely shit-faced, ended up in a fight, and I thought, fucking hell. And I felt, is this wrong? Is this right? Is this what the army's all about, sort of thing? But then I used to do horse guards, go down to do the parades and all that, with my face all like us, a broken nose, split lip, split eye. And then the regiment goes, enough's enough. So they took me out of the London scene and put me into Windsor, the green side. And at the point, my regiment had the highest AWOL rate in the British Army.
Wow.
Because lads were just not coping, thinking, what the fuck, is this what the army's all about?
So obviously the what you're known for is the sniping.
Yeah.
So how does that come about? Do people notice you and say they think you'd be good at it, or is it something you have to be interested in and apply for? Like, what's the sort of
process?
You
have to apply for it. When you go on tour and you're halfway through that tour, the sergeant major will come around and he goes, "What do you want to do?"
Right.
When you get back to England, what do you want to do? Because you need to do career courses to progress. And I say, "I want to be a sniper." They ignored me. Came back a couple of weeks later. "What do you want to do?" "I want to be a sniper." okay, ignored me again. And then I never come off that tour and I never achieved my snipering. And then I went tour again and he said, what do you want to do? I want to be a sniper. And badgered. And eventually they gave me the opportunity to become a sniper. So I went down to Purbright, down in Surrey, to start my sniper course. Now, I tipped up there, no pre-course, so I haven't got a fucking clue what's going on.
Right.
I didn't have a rifle. I didn't have a ghillie suit. And all these paras tipped up, all the guards tipped up with all their kit laid out. And I'd have stood there going, fucking out of my depth here. I haven't got a fucking clue.
So were you meant to have been given that stuff before you arrived?
Well, yeah, you meant to have a pre-course. Like, right. Good, so you got there with an understanding of what to do.
Right.
You know?
So whose fault was that it didn't happen?
My regiments.
Right, so they just sent you off without...
Sent me off, yeah, probably to keep my mouth shut, right. Saying he's going to come back in a few days, it's going to wear thin.
Got you.
You know, I got lent a rifle off the Coldstream Guards, and I was like, gleaming, never fired a sniper rifle before, and I was going, fucking hell, yeah, treasured it. And then every weekend I had off on that course, the course is about 9 weeks long, and every weekend I had off, I went home, and my wife never saw me, Tanya, because I was just building my ghillie suit, building ghillie trousers, making my life better in the field, becoming a sniper, you know, making my life more comfortable by coming up with ideas, going, I'm going to build this weekend. And I just flourished. And I became, I got top student. 30 started the course. Top of my head, I can't remember, I think six passed. Six or four on top of my head, but I came top student out of all of them. The first House of Cavalry. Now, they took the piss out of me, called me a donkey walloper, a horse shagger. You know, you fucking House of Cavalry. They go, every time you walk past them, you know. But so what? I became top student.
So what does it take to be a good sniper at a base level?
I remember being in Iraq, and I remember we went to a place called Al-Amara. In Iraq, and we had to fight to get this city. It was horrendous fighting, and I wasn't a sniper then. And we took over this football stadium, massive football stadium, and the Royal Irish were there. And I remember going for a walk just to clear my head a bit. I went in this football stadium, and I was just walking around the 400-meter track, and I looked up and I could see snipers pinpointed around the top on the high ground around the stadium. So I went up and spoke to one. Do you know, he didn't look at me. He didn't look at me once. He was stern, looking for the scope, everything. And I thought, yeah, that's what it's about. That's what I want to be.
Focus?
Yeah, focused, disciplined, committed to the job, you know, and wouldn't be afraid to squeeze that trigger to take a target out. And that's the most important thing of being a sniper. People think being a sniper, you go out and kill someone.
Mm.
It's not that. It's to gather information on the battlefield and then relay it back. And then you stay there for as long as possible, give that information, and they will tell you to take that shot or not if the target is feasible or it is a high-profile target. And that's what sniper's all about, you know. And they break you down. In the sniper school, they break you with fitness, running around. You don't have to walk anywhere. You've got to run anywhere. You've got to have your ghillie suit on all the time. You're sweating your tits off. You're knackered. You're tired. And, yeah, they break you down. And then they build you back up with a different discipline. So when you get back to the regiment, you're a different soldier, total different soldier. You're an A1 soldier.
So you get badged as a sniper, and then you're sent out for your first tour as a sniper.
Yep.
Do you remember the feelings that accompanied that?
Yeah, I was the only sniper in my squadron. I was the only sniper in the regiment. You know?
God. So when you're talking about the fact that your job is reconnaissance and providing information, that must have been a huge responsibility.
Yeah. My first going out as a role as a sniper was in Iraq when we invaded Iraq. There was no pressure on me at the time because we were all together. And we're all doing the same thing. But when you get called up saying, yeah, we need a sniper here, you know, and I'm like looking around going, that's fucking me.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You know, you grab your rifle and you go up. And I remember being in the desert in a place called the Maysan Desert.
Mm.
And it was vast, this desert. It's fucking hot and it's horrible. And we were in a MOG, like a mobile operational group.
Okay.
And it moves around the desert. And where there's an op going on, they can provide men to it. And it saves us going all the way back to Basra, to coming all the way forward again.
Right.
So we'd stay there. And should we just move around this desert? And you could be 100 miles from any location. And every time we stopped, we used to get mortared and we couldn't figure out what was going on. So we'd move to another location. Mortars would come in and they were aiming for the thing that the fuel truck, we call it an Oshkosh, but it's a fuel truck that was fueling all our wagons.
Right.
And they were aiming for that to blow. And if they hit that, I wiped nearly all the MOG out because it would have been just a horrendous explosion. And we noticed every time we stopped, there was a motorbike going by. And he was dicking us. And
dicking you?
Yeah. But you can't call him dickers anymore because it's demoralizing against him.
Okay.
So you had to call him scouts.
Right.
Yeah. So
he was scouting you?
He was scouting us, dicking us. Yeah. Still stick it. And he was dicking us. And he would go off next location, mortared. So I got called up to the ops room and they said, yeah, you need to take this guy out. And it was about 675 yards away. And I remember laying on this bank. The MOG moved off, left me there. And as the motorbike came into view, I took the shot. Now, in the heat, I don't know if you ever see it on films, when you see somebody in the desert walking towards you, they look higher. Mm. That's because of the heat shimmer. Mm. So I had to shoot quite high on the target because he looked quite tall on his motorbike. And I hit it and he wobbled and fell off the bike. Now I thought I hit the bike, but I hit the guy here because I went up to the body afterwards to clarify, you know, the information, to try and get stuff off him like maps and stuff like that. And I remember the throttle of the bike was stuck in the sand and it was revving its tits off. He had an AK-47 strapped to the bike. He had a radio called ICOM. Chatter on it. So the Taliban were talking to, or Al-Qaeda were talking to him, asking where he was, because I had an interpreter with me, and he was on the floor and he passed away.
And was it quite an odd feeling?
It was, yeah. I say it to this day now, I felt, fuck, I've killed someone. Mm. I've killed someone. I've shot someone. And I felt like I was going to get a tap on the shoulder at any minute and go, can we have a quiet word with you, mate?
Right.
Why did you fucking kill this guy?
Right.
You're going to prison now. But it wasn't like that. It was tap on the shoulder going, fucking a good job, mate. Fucking good job. And it took me a good week to get my mind in gear thinking, that's my fucking job.
Mm.
That's the job of a sniper, you know?
And I guess that's what you'd been training up to, yeah, up to that point. But
yeah,
yeah, again, for someone like me, I can't think about how it, because I haven't done the training,
yeah, yeah.
I haven't got the mindset, but I can't think about how much it felt. It must feel like a very odd thing.
It felt like I was hungry. My stomach was turning.
Right, right.
I'm gonna describe
butterflies
on. Yeah, butterflies. Yeah, be your bad butterflies. And I just remember sitting on my cam cot, because every time we stopped, we had, instead of sleeping on the floor, we had hammocks and cam cots. I used to sit on the end of my cam cot going, fucking hell, kill someone, you know? I kept it to myself.
Mm.
I didn't let it affect, you know, I put it in a box, put it in my brain, mm-hmm. You know, but it would always stay open now and again and I'd think, fucking hell, I've killed someone, I've killed someone.
Was it like a feeling of, if you don't mind me asking, was it like a feeling of guilt or more just strange?
Strange.
Strange.
Yeah, strange. You know, because you're in the army.
Yeah.
You expect to do something in that role at some point in your army career.
And presumably after you'd seen him and he was armed, you knew that he'd do the same thing back the other way
without
too.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And don't forget, he was trying to mortar us.
Mm.
You know, he was trying to mortar us and I engaged the target and my optics were quite powerful other than naked eyes so I could see, you know, what he was like and what he had on him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And he had maps on him as well. So the amount of intel we got off it, you know, the map of the Maysan Desert and he had pinpoints on where we were all the time. So,
oh, wow. So yeah. He had been...
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so it was him, yeah.
Dicking you, as you said.
Dicking us, yeah.
And then after that, you know, after the first one, which obviously would have had a big impact, did it get easier or did it? Was it a gradual, the feeling of oddness after each kind of, what do you say, kill?
Kill, yeah.
Does it start to feel more normalised or does it take a while before that?
It starts getting normal.
Yeah.
Because you believe your role as a sniper, you know, like I said before, first role, information, gather that information. Second role would be to neutralize, destroy, or suppress that target.
Got you.
You know, and it becomes more, not like gun happy where you just start blatting away everywhere, but you become, it matures you. it does mature you when you think, fucking hell, yeah. Because you can go up to anyone who's in the army, done 22 years, and you go, you ever shot your rifle in anger? And they've said, no, but I've done 22 years in the army. You know, or you can go to somebody and say, did you see conflict? Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I've shot my rifle as well. You know, it's 50-50 who you approach, you know. And, yeah, I'm one of them who's actually shot my rifle.
You know, one of the things that we did a video before, and the thing that people found fascinating was the relationship. Because snipers are as a pair, aren't they?
Often? Yes, they
that
are.
That was something that I think a lot of people hadn't realized before we made a piece before. Like, I think a lot of people think of the sniper as a solo operative out on their own. Can you explain a little bit how that relationship works to us?
There's, in a platoon or in a section, you have 16 guys, and them 16 guys are all snipers. So you work as a pair. So each of them 16 guys would be paired off with somebody else. And an officer who's in charge of you would always stay behind in the ops room and coordinate the snipers on the ground. There's no such thing as lone wolf anymore. You know, you just can't go out on your own. You know, even SF won't go out on their own. They always go out in force, you know. So there is a limit. So for me being a sniper and people more interested in it, more people wanted to, at the end of the tour, what do you want to do? Become a sniper, you know, and they got the courses. And it was up to me to give them the pre-course then.
Right.
So when they went on the course, they weren't going on blind. So, yeah.
Like you had.
Yeah, so like I did, yeah. And it's funny, actually. My number two, I did quite a few tours with, and we're both the same. So the number one is usually the better shooter, and number two is usually better at doing all the calculations, the barometric pressure, the altitude, the distance, the calculations on your scope. But me and my friend, I don't want to say his name, like, but we were good as a pair, and we took it in turns.
Oh, wow.
So then I'll be a number one, and he'll be a number two. And it's funny enough, coming here today, I bumped into him in the service station.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What, completely out of the blue?
I broke down. Totally fucked up. Totally fucked up. It gives me goosebumps. You know, totally.
What, just on your way to come here, you stopped off and he was there?
Funny enough, we stopped at a petrol station, and my wife goes, I don't want to stop here. I said, okay, then I'll go somewhere else. So we went to the service station, and she goes, this is better. Went there, and I was waiting for her, because she went to go and spend a penny. I was waiting for her, and as she came out, I heard Craig Harrison. Well, well, well. And I looked, and it was my friend I did so many tours with. And I was always in contact with him, But this last year, I've had my own issues. So I've segregated myself from certain things. And... Wow. And I broke down. He's suffers really bad. And he gets discharged out of the army this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, that's...
It's just fate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is fate.
Okay, so the guy that you were sort of partnered with, that you toured with, like, you know, you say that one of you is usually better at taking the shot and one's better at the calculations. Did you have a preference for either one?
Not really.
You like
no. Yeah, it gives you a breather beyond the scope as well, you know, because you're always on that scope, and you get like, you get tired more easily looking beyond the scope. And the spotter will have a spotting scope. Now, in that spotting scope, the graphical on that spotting scope is exactly the same in your sniper scope. So when he looks at something, and he will go, yeah, it's 3 mil, because you've got little dots in there, and they're called mil dots. And you go, yeah, it's 3 mil dots to the left. So you can get your rifle on that. And you can go, oh, yeah, there he is. You know, so you can talk you onto it. But you've got to have that relationship. And me and him had that click, you know. And then we went on and progressed in sniping. So we did our section commanders together. And then we did our platoon commanders together. And then we did advanced sniping together. So I couldn't go any more higher in the sniper world, you know, and nor could my number two.
It must be quite a bond you form.
Yeah, it really was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got to wipe your arse.
Yes, you mentioned that once before.
Do you know what I mean?
Do you want to, just because obviously someone watching for the first time might go, what does he mean by that?
Yeah, yeah. You can't move. You're in a location, you're on your belly, and you can't move. So you just get a little Tupperware tub, you roll over and go for a poo. He wipes your ass with a wet wipe, puts it in the container, puts it in his backpack. Because your idea is being a sniper is to leave no ground sign at all, you know? Because a good tracker is worth his, you know, weight in gold. We'll look at that poo and go, yeah, he's hydrated. He's eating well, his morale's quite high, you know, this is the guy we need to watch out for. You know, but you take it with you and you're a ghost on the battlefield.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, the ghost on the battlefield, when you say that, it's kind of like, I think that's what the romantic image sounds so cool, you know, yeah. If I'm being honest, to people who haven't been through that kind of thing, you think of that and it just sounds so amazing to be able to have that level of skills. Mm-hmm. And what would you say was like, what's an average length, or in fact, what's an extended length that you might stay still on the scope for?
Now a sniper is sustainable on the ground for 48 hours. For a max length of 72 hours would be the max, but normally 40
72 hours looking through the scope?
Yeah, but I've been beyond the scope for a week. Yeah,
in
Afghan in a place called Panda's Ridge. And I was on my own. I was on my own then. My number two wasn't with me.
So how does sleep work?
You catnap through the day. You know, so I'd rest my forehead on the scope and I'd catnap for about, I don't know, 15 minutes. And then I'd wake up and I'd stay awake for another 4 or 5 hours. Then I'd catnap again.
And, I mean, you must stand up from that at the end of the period of time and your body must feel like as stiff as a board.
You know? Yeah, you do, yeah, because you're not using your joints. What I used to do is dig a trough between my legs so I could piss and piss myself. And then it would go between the trough and it just trickle up behind me. So, and your rations that you have things, we call them dog biscuits. They're like brown biscuits. And right. The ration packs itself is high in calories, but it's also designed to constipate you.
God. Yeah.
So you're not shitting all the time, but you piss, constantly drink water. But in the heat anyway, like Iraq or Afghan, you don't get hungry. But, you know, you find out, anyone who's listening to this, you find when you go on holiday and you go to a hot country, you don't get hungry, you know, but, you know.
But how do you cope with this? Because like, what you're saying about going to a hot country, I can relate to that. You don't get hungry. Yeah. But then I'm walking around in a vest and some shorts. Yeah. You're in this full... Like, how do you not absolutely overheat?
We had special cam nets for the vehicles, and they're Israeli cam nets. Now, one, if you tip them the other way, they keep the heat in and they keep the cold air out for the winter. Flip them the other way and they keep the cold air in and they reflect the heat.
And they work?
And they work, yeah. Wow. Unless you're so tired and you flip it the other way and you wonder why you're sweating your tits off.
Yeah, in an oven.
And you realise you've got the cabinet the wrong way around.
Right. Yeah. I guess you'd realise that quite
quickly. Yeah, yeah.
And then, say, when you're in that position for, a week, you know, for you, you were talking about that fact that when you had somebody looking at your location, when you're in the morgue and reporting it back, you realised that somebody was watching you.
Yeah.
Is it the same the other way around? Like if you've been in an extended period of time in one position, do the people that you're observing start to realise that someone's there, or is it just the fact that you're just feeding back information and they never really get a sense of it?
They know you're there. Mm. They can't see you. And they look for that one shot. So that one shot, they disperse. They hate that one shot. Mm. So what I used to do is tell my support to open up with the GPMG machine gun and to disguise my one shot.
Ah, okay. So that creates a load of
noise,
chaos, and then your one shot slips through and does what it's meant to do.
Yeah. Wow. Otherwise, you don't hit your target. It's all about thinking what's on the battlefield, you know.
So you had quite a lot of, you know, influence over how everyone was working then, I guess, didn't you? If you could command and direct people to do different things.
Well, you think the naked eyeball to a times 50 scope magnification on it, you know, I could look at you at 1,000 yards and you're like this to me, you know, or a person with a naked eyeball looking that far would be going, oh, has he got a gun? Has he got a gun? I'll look at it and goes, yeah, he has got a gun, you know, so.
And when you talk there about the 250 metres, that makes me think immediately of the thing that you're very famous for, which is holding the world record for the longest shot. Do you mind talking us through that?
No, not at all. It was, I had 12 guys at this point because some of them had been injured. And
How many did it start with?
16.
Right, so four of them had come off the battlefield.
Yeah, even my officer. So I was doing an officer's job as well as a sergeant's job. And it's, you know, and I had loads of things on my mind, you know, because an officer has to do a lot of stuff as well behind the scenes. Well, anyway, this op was going on and it was in a place called Talijan. And this village was well-renowned for Taliban, well-renowned. And the British Army were mixing with the Afghan Army to teach them soldiering skills. Mm-hmm. And I remember being on the high ground because the Afghan army wouldn't move without support. So as soon as they saw vehicles on the high ground, it sort of gave them that fluffy feeling that they could walk into a village right. full of the Taliban.
Because you're looking over the top.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you could see them. And from my position, I could see everything keying up. And the patrol was walking towards the village itself, and I could see all the Taliban queuing up for the attack. I had ICOM with me, same again, the interpreter, and I'm going, what they're saying, he's relaying to me, yeah, they can see the patrol coming, they're waiting to get to the kill zone. Now, the kill zone would be a box or a field or anything where there's no cover, there's nowhere to run or anything like that, and they'll just open up and cause as much devastation as possible to that patrol. And I saw a glimmer. I thought, what the fuck's that in the distance? So I got my scope. Now, everybody thinks when I did my shot, I was laying down. I wasn't, I stood up.
Oh, holding?
Yeah, I was, oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I was leaning against a compound wall and I was pushing forward with my arm to hold the bipod because the walls are made out of cow shit, mud and straw. So every time I fired my weapon, a big chunk of wall would fall down from the shockwave. So I was holding my bipod with my hand. And
which means a bipod?
Would be the that holds the rifle up.
Right. So you're supporting that with
I'm supporting
hand.
That with my hand.
My God.
Yeah, because the wall was just crumbling away, you know. And I saw a glimmer in the distance. And I thought, so I looked for my scope and I could just make out a guy with a radio talking. So what I did, I fired one shot. Didn't get nowhere fucking near him. You know, I could see it fall. So I fired another shot, fell. I thought, fucking hell, how far is he? So I got my laser binoculars out and lasered it, and he just came out lines. So it's beyond.
And how far did they go, the laser? How far would that have read from?
Easy 1,500, 1,800 yards.
Right.
Laser too, you know, and I thought, I'm out here. So I put them down like, and I said, what I'm going to do, I'm going to bracket. So I put my scope on medium magnification. So I got a bigger, wider picture of the battlefield. And I fired one shot. Then I fired another, then I looked up, fired another. No, I called it lobbing in. I was lobbing in the rounds and my ninth shot hit the compound wall and I could see the splash of this compound wall and the icon went quiet and I thought, right, then it spoke up and I said, what's he saying? And he's saying, oh, that he can't direct the Taliban onto the patrol because he's getting shot at from somewhere and that person was me, you know, that one shot. So I left it there, went back to my other job, what I was doing. And I engaged multiple targets in this village.
So at this point, your group are under a heavy attack.
Yeah.
So they're all attacking, and basically the guy with the walkie-talkie was the one that was telling them what to
was
do.
Was orchestrating that
right,
attack.
Right.
And it's quite hard as a sniper to keep your mind straight because you're watching people get injured, you're watching people die on the battlefield, and you've got to keep your composure and not snatch that trigger, not get fucking angry. You're meant to stay calm, keep your breath calm, keep your heart rate down. That's what it's all about, and keeping your mind. And that's all your training comes together to do that, you know. And I engaged multiple targets. Now, my spotter was my driver, and I quickly talked him through the spotting scope, and he tapped me on the shoulder. He goes, there's somebody over there. And I looked over, and I could see somebody in the far distance, about 600 yards away. And I thought he was a marker. And I thought we're going to get flanked in a minute. They know, because I fired nine shots. And you're only meant to fire three to one shot and then move position.
Right, got you.
You know, before they find your location.
So you've done triple the amount.
Oh, yeah, massively. And I turned around, killed him, put him down. And it turned out not to be a marker. What he had done, he had knocked the head off the oil well, a water pump, and it flooded all the irrigation ditch. So where the fight was happening in the kill zone was just like a quagmire
right.
now because it was just all filling up with water. So I thought to myself, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Because I'm doing a sergeant's job, officer's job. I've got to think on the hoof now. I've got to really think. So I said, I'll take my vehicles down. I'll stay on the high ground, and I sent three vehicles down to act as a buffer between the patrol and the village, so like a barricade, so they can get their injured out and their dead out.
Are they still under fire at this point?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
God.
And then my lads are opening up on there, and I'm still engaging targets. Now, it went all quiet, all right? And when I did my nine shots, that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, This is now about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right. We're
still fighting. Now, a normal engagement, they do a thing called shoot and scoot, lasts for seconds, you know, and they fuck off. And they open up against somewhere else and they fuck off, you know, shoot and scoot tactics. And the engagement, you think in your head it's lasted for ages, you know, but it's only lasted for 5 to 10 minutes. This lasted until 2 o'clock and it went all quiet. And I thought, right, so I got on the radio and I said to my lads, come back. The patrol now are in safe ground. You know, they're tended to, they're injured and they're dead. I can't see the Taliban anymore. So I took off my vehicles to extract back. And as I looked at my vehicles coming back from my scope, all I could hear, do-do-do-do, and I thought, where's that coming from? And I could see splash marks in the water around my vehicles. And all the lads were on the ground, you know, taking cover. And I thought, where the fuck's that coming from? So I checked all my firing points and I couldn't find anything. The only thing I didn't check is in the distance. So I looked up and I could see two Taliban behind a machine gun called a PKM machine gun, belt-fed Russian machine gun. And it was just hoovering down rounds onto my lads. So I thought, fuck. So I looked at my lads, one got hit, and I thought, right, I've got to think. Keep calm, heart rate, brain, focus. And I fired my first shot. And don't forget, I hit the compound wall. So I know roughly why I'm shooting on the scope now.
Is that where they were, the same place?
Exactly the same place, yeah. They were laying down. And the first shot hit the side of the compound wall. And I thought, fuck. So I fired my second shot. And as the guy, one guy stood up, I hit him. Yeah, I hit him here. And he fell backwards. And the machine gun stopped firing. So then I fired my third shot. And as I fired my third shot, I moved my right foot across and fired my fourth shot. Now, the bullet of flight time was 6 seconds. So someone lift my rifle to got there. I was counting to 6 seconds before it hit the target. Now I've got my third shot and my fourth shot, 3 seconds behind each other. Third one missed, fourth one hit the guy, and it hit him in the side. And the only reason I know why I hit him is because you're meant to get that weapon. Stop it going back into enemy hands. And the weapon is gone. And it was just these Taliban were left dead. And an Apache helicopter came up next to me before I moved to go and see the dead guys. And the pilot was really low and he GPSed it at 2,475 meters, just over a mile and a half away.
And what's the official range of your rifle?
1,500 yards. Yeah.
How do you feel when you heard that?
I didn't know at the time, you know, because I didn't know they were even a world record. I know Rob Furlong was the guy, the Canadian guy. I didn't know there even was one, you know. And so I just cracked on with the rest of the tour, ended up getting shot in my helmet, ended up getting blown up, you know, and it was quite an horrific tour, my last tour was. And then shit hit the fan when I came home.
When you successfully engage that target and you kill those two guys, you know you've just saved all the people that now can extract. That must feel good.
Yeah, yeah, but it's funny, you don't rejoice or you haven't got time to rejoice because you're thinking ahead of your next task, your next mission, things like that.
I mean, moving on through that, were there any points in your career that you thought, this is it, I'm going to get killed in action?
Yeah, yeah. There are two of them, really, two of them. Now, I've had the Taliban walk in front of me probably 50 metres, and I've been on the ground, and they just walk straight in front of me, me and my number two, you know, and you're thinking, fucking hell, that was close. But I remember being in the building once and the Special Forces lads, SES, were doing an op. Now, nowadays, they've got a thing called FSG, which is One Power, and they do all their sort of like covering support and stuff like that. So you haven't got to worry about that. But before that was set up, they used to ask from the regiment, have you got any snipers? Have you got any lads we can borrow? Because they're busy on the ground. And they wanted two snipers. And it was me and my number two that went out. And we went to this building. And this building was like a building that Jack built. It was a multi-story building. Had 6 floors. And it looked like a multi-story car park. And it was made out of breeze blocks. And we went to the top floor and we had eyes on the op going in where the SAS did a snatch and grab of a high-profile target. And there was a mosque about 50 yards down from where they snatched this guy. And we had to stay there 2 hours after they'd done the job. So they snatched and they went. And next minute, a car bomb went off outside the mosque and they were coming out from prayer and it shook this building. And then we could hear a noise. And we went, what the fuck's that noise? And our cover had been blown. And the only way into this building was a spiral staircase in the middle. And the insurgents were clearing it in floor by floor. God. And we were on the top floor. And we said, we need to go. We need to go now. And that's the only time I've ever threw a flashbang. And it's like a grenade and it bangs six times and it disorientates you. And I remember going down the spiral staircase, I had my rifle out, and the spiral staircase was really small, like going down a castle one. And the only I could only have my pistol out because my rifle was too large to do anything. So I was going down to each floor, checking it. And we got to the third floor, and luckily they were right in the corner, away from the spiral staircase. And I just lobbed this stun grenade, and he went bang, 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 stunned him. And we went down to the bottom. And a vehicle reversed in, a tank, a Warrior, reversed in. The back doors opened and we all piled in the back and that was it. The vehicle just stayed there. And we're like, ah, fucking drive, drive, drive. The vehicle just stayed there. And we're like, ah, I'm chugging on the commander's leg. We need to fucking go now. And it turned out the driver had been hit in the head through a gap this big because he put the hatch down. And, he's... back of his head was gone and I was trying to hold it in. It was all over the commander's legs and brains and God knows what, and I was trying to hold it in, but he was gone. So we had to wait for another vehicle to come behind us to push us all the way into a safe location. Yeah, that was a bit touchy. And there's another one where I was in this place called the PJOC in Iraq. And this PJOC only had 18 people in. And it was me and my number two were sniper in there. And from probably 11 o'clock at night till 5 in the morning, gates of hell. Gates of hell would open. And they would try to overrun this facility. And the reason why they would try to overrun it is because there was a prison we were trying to protect and had hope rifle targets in and they were trying to get them out, you know. And it got to the point where I was in the sniper hide looking, taking targets out, and we were getting shot at everything. And it got to the point where I thought, fuck, we're going to get overrun here, you know. And I said to my number two, and I said, we're going to struggle here. We're going to struggle. We're running low on ammo, running low on sniper rounds, everything. And down the ladder was a Paradigm phone, and it was red. And it's where you just dial in a number on a little card you get issued, and it gives you credits, and you ring up home.
Mm.
And in the lull of the fight, I climbed down this ladder and I phoned Tanya up.
Mm.
I just wanted to hear her voice. And I get upset. I said to her, I said, I love you. And she goes, yeah, I know you do. What's wrong? She goes, what's all that noise? And I said, ah, just something going on. I said, but I love you so much. You know that, don't you? And she goes, yeah, I know you do. And she goes, I'll phone you in the morning. Promise you, I'll phone you in the morning. And I put the phone down and we cracked on. And we made it till morning and I phoned her back and I didn't tell her what was going on. I just said something was going off. I just wanted to tell you that I loved you. That was all.
Yeah, it's hard to listen to stuff like that and not feel a little bit, you know, emotional yourself. Something that's always seemed apparent to all of the crew whenever you've come in, because each time you've come in and we've met you, Tanya's come too.
Yeah.
And you two seem to have such an amazing bond together. And, you know, a lot of your stories...
She's my life support.
Yeah.
It was my dog. who passed away, mm-hmm. you know, a few months ago, old Betsy, who saved me from suicide, and Tanya. Yeah, fantastic woman. Can ask anything, you know, and she's always been there. Even when I'm in Iraq or Afghan, I'm in the fucking shit. She's always been there, you know, always been there.
We've met you before, and in the previous videos we've made, we talked about Betsy, and then she actually featured in one of the videos.
Yeah.
A lot of the comments we had on those videos went back to your relationship with her. It was very sad to hear when you came in today that she passed away. Do you mind telling the story of how she saved you?
We lived in America for 3 years. Them two guys that I killed in Afghan were two high-profile Taliban leaders. And I started getting death threats.
Mm. So they knew who you were?
They knew, because my information got leaked to the media when I came back to England. And my wife's name, my daughter's name, everything, even my dog's name, where I lived, everything. So we got an opportunity to go to America to live. And we moved out there. And Tanya went back to England to see her family. And I remember having a H&K Heckler & Koch 45 pistol. And it was on the dining room table. And where the dining room was the sofa. And I'd unload it. And I'd practice, put it in my eye, put it in my head. I put it in my mouth, so I gagged. Just getting fucking angry, you know, and then fucking hitting my head and everything going, and I couldn't take it anymore, you know, everything. So I put one round in, I cocked it, and I put it in my mouth. And I just fucking held it there. And I was pulling back on the trigger, and Betsy was on the back of the sofa. And she looked at me, straight in my eye, and she turned her head. And I looked at her and I sort of eased off the trigger and I put the gun down. And I reached out to somebody, a friend of mine who lives in Texas, and he was concerned. And the police came round to my house. And they knew about my story and everything. They knew who I was because the guy from Texas said, look him up. And he's all over the internet. This is this guy. He needs your help. And they took the gun away. And they wanted to take me with them, you know, for my own safety. But I said, I'm fine. I mean, convinced them that I was fine. Yeah, and she saved my life. And just the bond we had, you know, was just second to none.
Mm.
Second to none.
We've skipped a little bit there because we've gone from you being extremely successful in your career to obviously in a very, very dark and bleak place to try, you know, to think about something like that. Was that something that happened quickly or was that something that was a gradual build-up over a period of time?
When I was in Afghan, I hit a 30-kilo anti-tank mine. And it blew me out of the wagon. My driver, his legs were shattered, everything, and the vehicle was just demolished. And something clicked in my head.
Mm.
It was like all the tours that I've been on, everything that I've seen, everything that I've done, this wall had just fucking shattered.
Mm.
And I couldn't control my emotions. It was just like coming at me, and I'm just trying to fight him. You know, and I managed to subside them feelings. And when I got blown up, I broke my arms.
Mm.
I got a brain injury and my hips were knackered, you know, my hand. And I still couldn't control these feelings. And I remember going off that, I remember going into the Chinook helicopter, wrapped in tin foil. And that's the last thing I remember. And I remember waking up and all I could see was white. And all I could see was like psychedelic going past, people in white. And I thought, I'm fucking dead. That's what I felt. I thought, I'm fucking dead here. I'm dead. I'm fucking out. And I grabbed this one person. I reached out and grabbed them. And everything's white and I can't focus. Everything's blurred. And I grabbed this one person and I said, can you tell my wife that I'm sorry? Just tell her that I love her. Somehow get the message to her that I love her and I'm sorry. And they gave me an injection to counteract this painkiller. And I was in hospital. And the person I grabbed was a doctor. So I wasn't in heaven at all. You know, I wasn't dying. But I still couldn't control what was going on in my mind. They put me in plaster for 6 weeks because I broke my arms. The plaster was taken off. They made me do 10 press-ups and they sent me back out to Afghan.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. They sent me out and that's where I went onto Pounder's Ridge. And I was taking raw painkillers, sort of addicted to painkillers because I was getting migraines
a
hell of a lot. I couldn't focus. I felt a lot of guilt, a lot of anger, and I just couldn't control. And when I came off that tour, Tanya noticed it first.
Mm.
She noticed it first.
That there was something different.
There was something different about me, you know. And I'm quite open through my sex life, through being on my own, want to be on my own all the time, total isolation, my anger.
Mm.
Everything that not eating properly, not training, not doing anything, just felt worthless, you know. And then the army noticed it. And when the army noticed it, I got called in. And I'd done 23 years. It took half an hour to get kicked out. Half an hour. No thank you, no goodbye, no well done, or anything. Goodbye. Gone.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it.
You just, what is it, an assessment or what happens?
You sit a med board.
Right.
And the only reason that med board is to see what money you get when you come out.
Right.
It's not to go, fuck me, this bloke's fucking well fucked up.
So you go in there knowing they're going to let you go.
Yeah.
And they're just going to assess how much you should get paid to leave.
Right. Yeah. And you're gone.
You're any gone. Support network afterwards?
No, none at all. I pay out of my own pocket for my support.
So you left after that time with a lot of physical damage, mm-hmm. a lot of mental damage, yeah. and you just... back home.
Yeah. Sitting there, rocking. And they sounds bizarre, but you rock. You're just trying to focus and you're rocking yourself. And they just fill you medication, make you a zombie. You know, it took a good couple of years for me to find that equilibrium of medication to give me that happiness, to feel a bit of normality in my life. And to find that, I thought the lost spark between me and Tanya.
Mm-hmm.
But if you spoke to Tanya, she goes, never lost it. It's all in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And she says it sometimes now when I'm my bad days. You know, it's in your mind. You're okay. You're here. You know.
You said you grew up with a sheltered life.
Yeah.
And you went from a sheltered life into quite a macho life.
Yeah.
Prize fighting, then the military, and then you're out in the military. Did you think you knew what mental health was? Do you think you knew what PTSD was?
No.
Because what often a lot of the people that we talk to when they've gone through that sort of upbringing, you know, it's nobody's fault, but often they think it's something that happens to weak people or something that happens to people that don't understand what it takes to be what they are. Was that something you had to accept, the fact that you might be suffering from mental health? Was there a shame in there as well?
A failure to... accept it.
Mm.
You think there's nothing wrong with me.
Mm.
Nothing wrong with me. Come off meds. There's nothing wrong with me. What do I need medication for? And then you fucking crash.
Mm.
And then you become somebody that you're not, you know, and then you become to the dark place and then you start thinking of suicide and stuff like that. And it's, and then you have to accept it. You have to accept that you've got mental health issues.
Mm.
And sometimes I feel ashamed because... some people throw mental health around and there's nothing wrong with them. you know, and other people have got severe mental health and they deserve all the help they get, you know, and sometimes I feel ashamed to have mental health.
I think a lot of people still think it happens to people who aren't properly set up for things or yeah. things like that. And we did another piece with a veteran who explained it really well, as he said, like, because he had complex PTSD, and he basically described it as like, I got physical injuries there, and this is a mental injury I got there, and people just didn't get that it was the same deal.
Yeah.
Do you run into that ever? People that just sort of aren't really equipped to process it or understand it? Or yeah. do you think these days, is there a bit more understanding
no.
around it?
No one understands. I got an Instagram. And from Lad's Bible and me doing other podcasts, my following is massive.
Mm.
And I try to answer every single person that writes to me, comments-wise.
Did you get a lot off the back of the last?
Massively.
Really?
And it's people reaching out to me, you know, saying, yeah, I do this. I suffer from this. Mm. And it's me giving them support, going, look, this is how I coped with it. And this is how I deal with things like that, you know. And they're saying, oh, thank you for that, mm. you know. And Tanya's reaching out to Tanya as well, like the wives and girlfriends saying, how do you cope? My boyfriend does this, things wow. like this. How do you cope with? And Tanya's reached out to them as well, you know, because I think it's not understood. And it's took me a long time to realise that you've got military PTSD and civilian PTSD.
Right.
And is there a difference? And I don't think there is, because PTSD is PTSD,
mm.
you know. So you've got Fred down the road who's been knocked over by a car and it's horrific and he's nearly died. Now he's got PTSD. Or you've got me who's done 10 tours, seen horrific things, done horrific things, and I've got PTSD. It's the same thing.
Mm.
But doctors don't know how to cope with military PTSD. Mm. I've not got a fucking clue. And I've witnessed to it when I've gone to the doctor and all I've done is gone like that, printed a bit of paper off, go to the NHS Veterans Mental Health. So you think, all right. So you go there and they don't know what to do. You know, they give you five sittings, sessions,
mm.
and that's that. That's you gone. After them 5 seconds and you go, well, I still feel the same. Where do mm. I go from here? You know, or you can reapply in a couple of months' time. I might be hanging from a tree then.
Mm.
You know, so there is a massive failure in people with PTSD, especially with veterans or ambulance drivers, fire brigade, police officers. There's a massive
suppose letdown. The thing there that you've described as well, which feels unfair, is that the police, the veterans, the fire officers, they've basically done that job to help other people,
yeah.
serve their country,
yeah.
and it's as a direct result that they might have had some problems or difficulties, mm. and the fact that there isn't a kind of safety net or support network no. when they come out seems yeah. quite unfair.
No.
Do you feel... What's your feeling towards the army now?
Bitter.
Mm.
Angry. The way that they do things. But I'm one person. The army's a massive thing,
mm.
you know. And I always... It's funny, I always give the same information my granddad gave me when I was a child.
Mm.
And if anyone says, I want to join the army, I say, join the engineers. Join the engineers, get a trade. Become a bricklayer, carpenter, surveyor, anything. And you can become airborne. You can go for special forces as an engineer. You can do this, you can do that. And he goes, but leave the army with something that you can fall back on. And that's the only information that I can give anyone that is wishing to join the army. You know, is get a trade. Don't think of yourself as a grunt on the ground and you want to join the infantry. Get yourself a trade.
You had a lot of incredible experiences and you had some experiences that have caused you a lot of difficulties and challenges. If you could go back and do it again, would you take the same path?
Now, I went for SF training and I got a really bad injury in my knee and I didn't finish selection. And then I'm married, got married, and then I found out in Hereford there's like a 95% divorce rate and things like that.
Right.
And it's not what I wanted,
no.
you know, because they're under demand, everything. So I've sort of like scratched it off. But if I was in the right frame of mind, that's where I would have gone. And that's my biggest regret, is not following that,
Special forces.
As a special forces. You know, not following that, and hat off to people that have done SF training and stuff like that, you know.
And do you think it would have been a different outcome if you'd done that?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. And it's interesting because last time we met, you hadn't lost your finger.
No.
So these injuries are still playing back. And that was caused by the explosion, is that right?
Explosion, yeah. And they suddenly just cut my finger off. And I spoke to you earlier, I've got a hip replacement now on my right hip. And I'm just waiting to get the left one done as well due to the explosion.
How long after the explosion did they remove your finger?
Oh, it took ages.
Years.
This was done last year.
Right.
They took my finger off because no one's willing to do it. I had to go to a veteran surgeon.
And that was complications that were caused by the explosion. Yeah. So how long is that, like 5 years, 10
years? 5 years.
5 years afterwards. Yeah. Wow, so it's still causing all these ongoing...
And you have to fight for it. It's not the fact that you can go to the GP and go, I've got issues. You know, it's like my hip replacement. Mm. I'm 47 years old. No one's going to touch me with a hip replacement. Mm. So I'm young, you know. I had to go to a special doctor. You said, yeah, I'll take your case on. He x-rays everything. He went, fucking hell, you need new hips.
Right. You're someone that got hit with a lot of challenges, but you have turned them into a positive. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to touch on at the end here about your survival school, because I remember when we did the last video, it was something you were thinking of.
Yeah.
I think we actually did a fundraiser for
you.
A sort of Kickstarter, which was amazing, because that was something that was just viewers feeling so sort of inspired by your story that they wanted to donate something. And can you talk us through your survival school?
Yeah, I've got access that I let 52 acres of woodland down where I live, and opened the bushcraft school, survival school to teach bushcraft. And I do a lot for mental health. Now, you could be having the worst day of your life, and just to get away in the woods and totally relax and breathe a bit and talk to somebody that experienced mental health themselves has been phenomenal. And I haven't stopped this year. And it's thanks to the Lad Bible that kicked it off, you know, with a fundraiser, that I've managed to get all my bits and bobs, you know, and trying to still get bits and bobs, you know. But the school year is going from strength to strength, you know. Trying to look for a sponsor at the moment so I can offer, instead of people paying, the sponsor could help me out so I could offer free spaces to people with mental health issues.
Amazing.
And say, look, come on down. This is what... And I've done many a time where I've just gone, I've done the school for a whole month, and then 3-4 weekends, I've not been paid myself at all. I've just told people to come down for free because I want people to feel relaxed. And
is that anyone that feels like that?
Civilian, military, anything.
Anything.
I've had people, I've had alcoholics, I've had people with split personality, schizophrenia, I've had veterans that have got severe PTSD. And the response I've had after they finished the school, you know, is that you've changed my life around, Craig. And I remember one guy woke up and he said, it's the first time in 3 years that I've woken up without a hangover.
Jesus. That must make you feel amazing.
Yeah, it does, yeah. And you think to yourself, fucking hell. And he went to bed again. And he woke up the next morning and he goes, that's two nights now, Craig.
Amazing. It's such a lovely thing to hear. And I guess the final thing that I would ask is, if there's anyone watching this who is feeling as you did after leaving the military, is starting to feel that they're not right, or people around them are telling to them that they're not right, or, you know, something's different in a negative way, what would be your message to them?
Talk. Everyone says it, don't they? Talk. Talk to your parents. Talk to your brother, your sister. Talk to your best friend. All right? And I'm offering that out now. If you really are struggling, reach out on my Instagram and talk to me. I'll talk to you. I don't care if it's like 4 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm always there to talk to on the end of the phone. All right? And if you are struggling totally and you want to get away, come to the school.
Listen, Craig, it's the third time you've been in.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure.
And I mean, for us too, every single time we meet you, it's just, you're just overwhelmingly inspirational individual. I know that the crew all think that. We did a 100th episode Q&A recently, and your episode was picked out by a lot of the crew as their favourite one. Okay. That had an impact on them.
And, cheers, guys.
Yeah. And thanks so much for your time again.
No worries. Been a pleasure.
Cheers.
Thank you.
So that was an interview with Craig Harrison. I'm joined here by Josh, who directed that episode. How do you think it went?
Yeah, it's special, powerful. You know, it's an incredible story. It's incredible in story of resilience. Also kind of that political side of it, of just how, to be honest, like the UK Army treat its veterans and kind of how much needs to be done and how little is done. And it kind of has everything in terms of the physical, mental endurance of being a sniper, a great deal of which I had never heard. What goes into making it, and then his story, his personal story, what he's gone through, what he's come through, and kind of there's this sort of at least some element of peace and safety with it, where he's at now. But yeah, really powerful. Could listen to him all day, very articulate. Couldn't have enjoyed it more, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's the third video we've done with him. It's actually the fourth video, but the third one where he's come in and we've met him. And each time there's something about when he talks where he'll be talking normally incredibly well and sort of very vividly describing something. And then there's the odd story he tells where it affects him and his face just changes. And when someone you're looking at starts to cry, essentially, it's really hard not to have that response yourself, especially with someone like him that's just a massive, tough-looking guy. Seeing the things that affect him be his wife and his relationship with this little lovely sweet dog, it's just, there is something about it that makes you feel like you're about to go as well.
He's incredibly gentle.
He is gentle,
which is like he is the archetypal looking army sniper. So I think that adds so much, and I think because he just actually that is actually who he is.
Danny, you did the first one.
Yeah, I did in the first couple of times, Craig. An amazing man, but it's like you end up after doing these, you follow a few of the people on Instagram, some of the people you've like kind of, and every time you see one from Craig and he's doing well, or he's out doing after dinner speaking or something, it's a really nice feeling, because it's just like, it's good to see him. He does have good days too. And like we might see stories here where he's crying and sad and stuff, but it's like, he actually had, there's a lot to him.
It was really nice actually. He spoke at length in this video about the impact doing the original video had on him and the money that kickstarted the survival school and all that kind of thing. And that was actually like a really nice thing to hear.
Yeah.
There was a positive impact from doing it.
What was your biggest takeaway from the episode?
I think how badly we treat our veterans, to be honest. I think everything that they give, and I kind of hear it across the board with the army, it feels like you're a gun for hire, literally, while you're a young man, and then you go through a lot. And like the way he was in that bomb attack, did 10 press ups, sent back. Like it's get out as soon as you can, and then there's no aftercare. There's no let's think about their purpose in society, what they can do after being in the army. So in terms of that, that probably was my biggest takeaway.
I always think after every video, because he talks about it in every video, but I just always think his relationship with his wife is so nice.
Special, isn't it?
Special, because like they always come in together every time, and it just seems like they're a really good team. Like they've had some really difficult times, and the fact that they're still really strong. We went out to speak to them, you and I, after we'd shot, and he came out of the bathroom and he walked up to next to her, and they just sort of like automatically held hands.
Gravitated without, together.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's just really nice to see.
That was, yeah.
I thought it was interesting. I didn't realise when he said that people have reached out to him on his Instagram, but they've also reached out to her, like the wives of people who've served, other partners who are having similar problems have reached out to her for advice. And that was also a nice thing to hear. For anyone watching that's been affected by any of the things that were discussed in this episode, there'll be links in the description below.